Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is 2022-0787 in the matter of Lamar Thomas versus John Luge, Administrator of the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Keller, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. My hope was to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if needed. This case is about the Bureau's statutory right to subrogation, and the analysis really takes two steps.
Tell me exactly how the independent medical review, not with the legal stuff, just if we're walking down the street, how does it benefit the claimant?
The claimant has the burden of proof, Your Honor.
Yes, I know that.
The benefit comes from the fact that the Bureau is taking, we like to celebrate the workers' compensation system as a non-adversarial process, and part of the reason it's non-adversarial is because of the steps the Bureau takes to make the process non-adversarial, which include, we use the word independent, but there's really nothing in the statute that requires it to be independent. The important part is that it is evidence that builds on an initially unconvincing record. And I think it helps to divide the analysis into two steps, if I may. The first step is one of statutory interpretation, specifically understanding what it means for the Bureau to pay a cost on the claimant's behalf. And then the second step, which is I think what your question is getting at, is one of regulatory interpretation. And when we look at how the Bureau has structured its regulations, the Bureau's purpose in incurring costs in cases like Thomas's is to help a claimant build on their initially unconvincing record. So let's start with the statutory text. We talk about this as subrogation, but it's really a statutory right to recovery, as this court has said in cases like McKinley. And the most relevant statutory language here is the subrogation definition located at Revised Code 4123.93D. And that language tells us that the Bureau's subrogation interest is made up of both medical benefits and any other costs paid on behalf of the claimant. So just from that nature of that list, we know that Thomas's principal theory of his class action must be wrong, because in his view, subrogation is limited to medical treatment. But we already know from the subrogation definitions list that these other costs on behalf of are something different than medical benefits. So we have to give that language some meaning. And as far as I can tell, even with as deep as we are into this issue, I do not understand what work Thomas thinks this on behalf of language is doing.
But how is it constitutional to give the Bureau a windfall because Thomas did not actually apply for reimbursement of that particular cost?
So there's no windfall here. What I think we need to look at the Groach decision to answer that question, in particular paragraphs 63 through 80 of that decision. And what that case says, it applies a traditional form of rational review to these types of constitutional challenges. We don't have a constitutional challenge here, we have a statutory challenge. So we do need to have a reasonable interpretation of the text before we can get to any constitutional issue. But regardless, there's no serious constitutional issue here, because what Groach tells us, and I'm particularly thinking about paragraphs 77 to 80 of the decision, that it's perfectly reasonable to view things from the perspective of the statutory subrogee. And when we do so, we see that there's no dispute here that the Bureau pays for these medical reviews and medical exams out of the state insurance fund. So there's no windfall to the Bureau. It's getting back a partial recovery under the subrogation formula of items it's paid out. And Groach tells us that's perfectly reasonable in the constitutional sense. It's up to the General Assembly to balance the tug of war that's going on between employers and workers in any type of workers' compensation statute.
But Counselor, but two things. One, couldn't the medical review not support the claimant's claim, one? And two, should you be allowed subrogation for costs that the claimant didn't receive as part of its award?
So for one, you're certainly right that it's possible that a medical review comes back unfavorable, although the Bureau never builds the record by the time, let me rephrase, the Bureau has never chosen to dispute the claimant's request at the time it builds the record. So at this stage, the Bureau's purpose isn't trying to build a record against the claimant. It doesn't need to because the claimant is the one that holds the Bureau. As to the second part
of your
question.
But it does. So in the instance, it clearly doesn't benefit the claimant.
No, well, the question isn't whether it benefits the claimant. The question is whether the motive of the Bureau, whether the action is taken on behalf of the claimant. That's our view of ordinary meaning of on behalf of is more of a motive phrase than a result phrase in hindsight. And so what we're asking here is whether the Bureau, at the time it incurs a particular cost, is doing so in the interest of the claimant. And as to the second part of your question, subrogation is whatever the statute tells us it is. And as I answered with Justice Bruner's question, Groch tells us that from a constitutional sense, there's nothing unfair here about thinking that the Bureau should get back a portion of costs that it undisputedly pays out from the state insurance fund.
I understand that, but is the cost undisputably reimbursed to the claimant?
I guess I don't know what you mean by reimbursed. I think why the cost is in the interest of the claimant goes to how the Bureau has structured its regulations.
Well, so what I mean by, so if the claimant's award says, these are all my medicals, and they're being reimbursed for that, and then there's other reimbursement maybe for pain and suffering or some other things, but the list of medicals are presented, and if the independent medical review is not in that list, then how is it that the Bureau gets subrogation from something that the claimant didn't put in the list as something that I have to pay back?
Well, so the claimant does get the notice of the Bureau's subrogation through the process that's laid out.
But does they get notice that independent medical claim is part of the subrogation?
Absolutely, yeah. So if you look at the 0.931 G and H provision, it's set up in a way where the claimant finds out before their case either settles or goes to litigation with the tortfeasor what the Bureau is including in its subrogation interests. So these items are recoverable from the tortfeasor in some way, shape, or form. We argue on page 7 of our reply brief that the claimant can recover them directly, but even if the court doesn't agree with that, the claimant's certainly capable of bringing the Bureau into the underlying tort litigation so that the tortfeasor and the Bureau can sort out any disagreement about the subrogation demand. I do want to get back to the Bureau's regulatory motive here, because I think that's the key second step in the analysis. When we're thinking about an agency's motive that acts pursuant to written regulations, and here we don't have any indication in the complaint that the Bureau was somehow going off script. Thomas's pleadings actually align very well with how the Bureau has structured its process. And so if we think about how the Bureau has structured its regulations here, a claims processor faces a fork in the road at the initial review process. Either it can award benefits if it's convinced by the application, or if it's unconvinced, it needs to build the claimant's record. And for costs incurred during this record building function, I do think we can fairly say they are in the interest of the claimant, because what's going to happen, if you think about the world, if this record building function didn't exist, what's going to happen to that claimant's claim is it's going to fail.
But your facts aren't accurate, because what happened here was that there was an award, and then he went to his doctor. The doctor said, this is an exacerbation, the injury is an exacerbation of a prior malady that you have. And it was at that juncture that the Bureau decided to ask for the independent medical examination. That was not filling a hole in the record. That was trying to rebut additional benefits.
It was filling a hole in the record. Let me unpack what happened in Thomas's situation to see if I can convince you of that. So it helps to compare his initial claim to his additional request that your question is talking about. His initial claim was very uncontroversial. I got in an automobile accident. My neck and back got sprained. Bureau awards benefits. Then about a year later, Thomas gets much more aggressive in terms of workers' compensation theory. He wants recovery for a degenerative pre-existing condition. And if we go look at revised code 4123.01 and specifically C2 and C5, that's a very aggressive theory that requires a lot of evidence. You need more than just a doctor's note. You need objective medical testing that shows that this degenerative pre-existing condition isn't something that existed in the past. And we don't have from Thomas's pleadings that he actually came forward with that type of evidence, which is why the Bureau needed to go build the record through its record building function. And in doing so, obviously, as Justice Stewart's question got out, this didn't turn out well for Thomas, but if we're looking at the Bureau's motive at the time it incurred these costs, it at least increased the chances here that Thomas would be able to succeed on what was a pretty aggressive
plan. Let me ask you about that, because I guess that's not obvious to me. I mean, wouldn't it make sense that, at least in many situations, a claimant would rather just rely on their own medical evidence, even if the Bureau didn't think it was sufficient at the initial stage, but go through the process, maybe go through litigation, rather than have the Bureau do an independent medical examination? And if it's something that a claimant wouldn't want done, how is it done on their behalf?
I think we can come up with specific fact patterns that where that may be, but if we're looking more system-wide at the regulatory level, which is, again, how I think you discern the Bureau's motive, I don't think that's the case, because what the Bureau is doing, I think on average a claimant would prefer, if you don't think my evidence is good enough, then go out and get me more evidence so we know that we're not rejecting claims based on technicalities or a lack of information. But even if I don't have you convinced that these record-building costs are always included within a cost incurred on behalf of the claimant, you should certainly also reject what seems to be Thomas's and the 10th District's view that they're never included. And let me give an example to sort of illustrate that. So whether it's due to insufficient...
Well, before we get there, so if we have a sometimes view, then what do we do with this case?
If you have a sometimes view, then it would depend on whether you think Thomas has pled enough to get himself within the sometimes, and then it would go back down. But even if you're going to send us back down for further factual development to figure out more about what happened with Thomas's claim, I do think you should do so by correcting the 10th District's mistaken legal reasoning, which seems to suggest that the Bureau acts out of a purely administrative motive, but that doesn't make much sense when one thinks about what .93D is saying. The subrogation definition anticipates that the Bureau does at times act on the behalf of the claimant, and I can't tell, again, from Thomas's reading or from the 10th District's reading what work they think this on behalf of language is doing. We don't usually interpret statutes in a way that just strikes out a final clause of a statutory provision.
Let me ask you about the administrative point, because, I mean, you spend a lot of time, the other side spends a lot of time, the 10th District says these are administrative costs. The 10th District could be wrong about that, right? They're not necessarily, they could be in a category where they're not administrative cost, but they're not subrogal, right? Is that, am I missing something there?
No, that's possible, but I think the situations in which you have a cost coming out of the state insurance fund that's not subrogation are going to be pretty narrow. But certainly the 10th District was mistaken in casting all these as administrative costs. There's really two buckets to keep track of here, and they're mutually exclusive. Money that comes out of the state insurance fund includes costs for exams, recommendations, and determinations, and that's funded in an entirely separate way than administrative costs, which are really more about the overhead of the workers' compensation system. So that is another problem with Thomas's reading. It doesn't reconcile those, because there's no dispute here under the language of 4123.30, as well as this court's decision in Northwestern Ohio Building, that the Bureau can pay these costs out of the state insurance fund. But I do agree that once we know these costs came out of the state insurance fund, then we have to look at the Bureau's motive, but not in hindsight, at the time it incurs the costs.
Your position is essentially that these are done on behalf of the claimant.
Correct.
But, I mean, isn't the Bureau's interest really more systemic? It's more, we want to make sure good claims are paid and bad claims aren't paid, and we're doing this on behalf of all claimants to make sure the right claims are paid, but it doesn't seem to be on behalf of this particular claimant.
I certainly agree that the Bureau has an interest in getting it right, But I also don't think that's inconsistent with taking actions on behalf of the claimant during at least this initial record-building stage. And the reason that is there are different ways to get a claim right. Legally speaking, it is perfectly right to reject a claimant's claim. They have the burden of proof. If they don't come forward with evidence, there's nothing legally wrong with that type of holding. But the Bureau doesn't want to get claims right in that narrow legal sense. It wants to get claims right by making sure it's filtered out any technical or just inability to build the record type of reasons. Imagine a claimant that, for what, obviously workers' injuries is going to be a stressful time in someone's life. Imagine a claimant either because of resources, knowledge, for whatever reason is incapable of building the record themselves. Certainly, at the very least, that claimant is going to benefit from the fact that the Bureau has built this record building function into its system. So even if you don't agree with what we think is a narrow but categorical rule as to these record building costs, you should certainly reject what seems to be the alternative categorical rule Thomas is presenting.
So let me make sure I have this right, based on this discussion this morning. At this initial review, they have the burden. If someone reading that record says they have not proven by clear and convincing evidence that this is related to the industrial injury, the Bureau can just say denied. Then it's up to them to challenge that and or they personally go out and get further evidence to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that this really was part of the injury. Instead of saying you're out, the Bureau is now taking the next step to say we're going to do an independent medical exam to see if there is evidence to support their claim. And if there is, they get the benefit of that. If there isn't, then the initial review, which was it's denied, goes back to that.
I agree with you on almost everything there. The only minor correction is it's preponderance of the evidence, not clear and convincing. But the other thing I would add to that is nothing in the Constitution or the revised code requires the Bureau to have this record-building function. So I do think an important question here, because again, I think we have to assess the Bureau's motive on the system-wide level, is would it be a good thing if the Bureau just, for claimants, if the Bureau just eliminated this record-building function from its process? I think it's pretty obvious the answer is no.
So just to go back to it, the answer is yes. At initial review, if whatever they've submitted does not, by a preponderance of the evidence, demonstrate that it's connected to the industrial injury, it can summarily be denied.
I think I got confused by it. Legally speaking, if the Bureau did not have this record building function built into this process, it could justifiably deny claims just based on insufficient evidence. The reason it doesn't do so with how the current process works is because it has placed this record building obligation on itself. So I'm sorry if I misanswered your first question. I think the reason this has happened is because of the Bureau's self-imposed regulatory obligation, which we think reveals the Bureau's motive.
Well, that's an administrative rule.
Yes, yeah, it's a 4123-3-09B1 of the Administrative Code.
Would you haven't discussed Holton at all, which essentially would seem to apply here. I know you cited Groch, but how would you distinguish the Holton holding?
I think that Holton cannot be read independently of Groch. If you look at paragraphs 63 through 80, Groch returned to a much more traditional rational basis type of analysis. And Groch was actually the case dealing with the current subrogation formula. So even if we might have problems if we return to a system like was at issue in Holton, here we have the system that Groch blessed as constitutionally reasonable.
Except Groch dealt with undercompensation and that the BWC and the injured worker shared in the undercompensation. It did not negate the double recovery principle that's in Holton. That's bedrock. And so how do you get around that?
If you look at paragraph 63 of Groch, it basically recast Holton, not as requiring some type of precise matching requirement, but just requiring some level of correlation. And then if you go to the later parts of Groch's analysis, this is the 77 through 78 through 80 paragraphs, it said that The reason why there's a legitimate relationship here is because we're allowed to view things from the subrogee's perspective as well.
Except I don't know what happened to the grand bargain, because you said in the beginning of your argument that this is not an adversarial process, but what the result is for this injured worker and many other injured workers with this process is that whether you get your full $6,000 and some dollar amount or $5,443, you're still taking that money away from the injured worker's ultimate recovery.
You're taking a part of the subrogation interest, only a part, not the full amount, based on the formula that Groch approved. And this court has rejected on at least a couple different occasions the idea that we're reading statutory subrogation statutes through like a fairness lens. I think that any, to the extent we're talking about like the impracticality or absurdity canons, then I think we get by any concern there based on the fact that Groch says we can legitimately consider the statutory subrogee's perspective. But I do think that the process is non-adversarial in large part because of the steps the Bureau takes at this initial stage to relieve the burden. I mean, we're talking about a narrow sliver when we're of the whole system when we're talking about subrogation. I think we also have to think about all the other injured workers who aren't injured by tortfeasors and how the record building function works for them too.
But I'm just looking at this, and so the Bureau asked for the independent medical examination. It wasn't something that was really, and it served to deny that claim. So then the injured worker went against the third party tortfeasor, got a recovery, and so how in your stewardship question, in your historic or grand bargain question, is it justifiable when the injured worker didn't get compensation for that independent medical examination, the Bureau does?
Sure, they did get compensation in a way, and here's how to think about it. This, no dispute, this money comes out of the state insurance fund. And if the Bureau didn't do this record building function, it would be the claimants who would need to pay for this record building.
Or they could just rely on their own medical records that are submitted that support the claim they're asking for.
They could, but if we've gotten to the record building stage, it already means the Bureau at least has felt like the claim isn't supported.
So they're doing it in their interest.
No, I think the system is structured in a way where the Bureau, I mean, is it possible the Industrial Commission can disagree with the Bureau? Sure. But I think the fact that the Bureau finds it unconvincing is a good sign that it's not going to be convincing in the end if it goes through the process without further evidence. There are no further questions. We ask that you reverse and reinstate the dismissal of the Court of Claims. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court.